From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Sam Hirschman.
And I'm Kyle Crawford.
This week on War News Radio, organizing. We learn about labor movements in Iraq. Then, we consider the role of foreign correspondents. Next, we hear a report on the Obama administration's troop increase in Afghanistan.
Finally, we hear about Baghdad's famous Al-Rashid Street.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Ayad Alawi has indicated that he will join the new Iraqi government, being led by his political rival, current Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Alawi's agreement to join the new government, after previously vowing not to, is an important step towards Iraq's stability.
Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, the Obama administration's special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, died after surgery to repair a tear in his aorta. President Obama appointed Holbrooke to lead diplomatic efforts with Afghanistan and Pakistan, including trying to convince Afghan President Hamid Karzai to rein in corruption inside the country.
A bill that would end the military's "don't ask, don't tell" policy passed the House by a vote of 250 to 175. The bill now moves to the Senate, where it appears there may be some bipartisan support. It is unclear whether the Senate will have time to consider the bill before the end of the lame duck session.
The UN Security Council voted to lift sanctions that were imposed on Iraq in 1990, when Iraq, governed by Saddam Hussein, invaded Kuwait. The sanctions were meant to keep Iraq from developing nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons.
The White House released a report on President Obama's strategy for Afghanistan. It was the first evaluation of the 30,000 troop increase implemented last year. Karim Sariahmed has more on the story later. This is War News Radio. When Saddam Hussein's government collapsed in 2003, the United States worked to reform a number of laws. One they missed, however, continues to affect the majority of Iraq's workforce, and has many of them and their supporters organized against it. Kate Aronoff has the story.
Last July, employees of Iraq's Ministry of Electricity faced a series of police raids at their offices. Their records were confiscated, their leaders were questioned, and the offices where the raids took place were shut down. These workers also happened to be members of the Electrical Utility Workers Union, and they faced serious charges. Abdullah Mohsin, an Iraqi labor activist, explains the implications of these raids.
Anybody organized will be charged under the Terrorism Act. This is extreme, and in a sense, if you organize, if you are trade unions, we charge you under the Terrorism Act. We are not terrorists. We are Iraqis. We want to see Iraq flourish. We want to see Iraq democratic. And we paid heavily with the blood in order to see Iraq develop. And we suffered terribly. We suffered more than anybody else.
Labor organizing has a long history in Iraq, but one that's often overlooked. Saddam Hussein regime-era labor laws outlawing unions remain in effect. These laws are enforced by government-issued raids and carried out by police. While legislation on the matter remains stuck in parliamentary limbo, activists and workers in both the public and private sectors struggle to organize and create a voice for themselves in the emerging government. Unions in Iraq serve essentially the same purpose as in the United States. They ensure groups of workers the right to negotiate more fairly with management in a process known as collective bargaining. In Iraq, however, these unions also happen to be illegal. Iraqi unions must therefore serve dual purposes, as advocates on a local level, for better workplace benefits and job protection, and on a national level, as activists and lobbyists for their own recognition. Shauna Baderblau is the Acting Regional Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa Department of the AFL-CIO's Solidarity Center.
There are at least six major trade union federations in the country and many other unions that are not affiliated to federations at all. They are organizing workers both in the public sector and in the private sector and actively trying to defend workers' rights both vis-a-vis employers and vis-a-vis government.
Given these unions' legal status, however, involving large numbers of workers in the trade can prove difficult. While much of the membership is based in the workplace, labor activists also play a crucial role in advocating for workers' rights on scales both large and small. Shamal Ali has worked with prominent activists in organizing two of Iraq's largest unions, the Unemployed Union in Iraq and the Federation of Workers' Councils and Unions in Iraq.
Yes, I'm with all respect to all labor activists in Iraq, activists in Iraq. I say that you can't call those organizations real workers' union. I mean, they are a tent, and they are very. I mean, I am very proud to be one of those who saw the beginning of this process. Very positive and important activities going on there by labor activists. But I say that's only the beginning.
A large part of what activists are fighting for is the repeal of Iraq's antiquated labor laws, which date back to Saddam Hussein's rule. Perhaps the most controversial of these is Law 150 of 1987, which prevents workers in the public sector from unionizing. Under the Saddam government, all public sector employees were qualified not as workers, but as civil servants. The majority of workers in Iraq are employed in the public sector, which includes the ministries of oil, electricity, and industry, among others. Their redefinition in the 1980s as civil servants means that substantially less than half of the country's workforce can legally join or form a union. The Coalition Provisional Authority, the transitional government installed by the United States following Hussein's ousting, worked at various levels of the Iraqi government in 2003 and 2004 to make widespread legislative changes. While labor group support attempts were made to change the code, it remains untouched. Further restrictions to labor were made as recently as 2005 with the adoption of Decree 8750. This grants control of all trade unions' funds to the Council of Ministers, a governmental body which oversees Iraq's main state-run profit-making industries. Shamal Ali returned to Iraq in 2003 following the collapse of the Saddam government.
They talk about everything, whatever Saddam Hussein regime done, for example, against religious group, against nationalist group, but when it came, against workers, it's okay for them. So they didn't change anything in regard to laws that issued against the workers' rights.
Interestingly, both Decree 8750 and Law 150 contradict Article 22 of the Constitution of Iraq, which grants the right to form and join unions and professional associations. The Constitution, ratified by referendum in 2005, represents public opinion far more accurately than previous labor laws. Still, it is the old laws barring unionization that are enforced. Abdullah Mohsin, foreign representative of the International Federation of Trade Unions in Iraq, discusses the irony of the situation.
Yes, people went and voted, and there is a clear article saying people have the right, workers have the right to organize and to collective bargaining. But this has to be done through a flesh, through proper legislation, I presume, the labor law.
The ministers of Iraq's profit-making sectors, oil, industry, petrochemical, and otherwise, have the power to issue decrees ordering police to raid trade union offices. The decree for one raid called for those protesting to be charged as terrorists, as outlined by Iraq's Anti-Terrorism Act of 2005. While public sector workers are the most obviously affected, those attempting to organize in the private sector have been subject to raids as well. Shauna Baderblau tells of one such instance.
We've also even seen in the private sector where in Baghdad earlier this year, one of the trade union organizations was trying to organize taxi bus drivers. And in a that worked for a private company, and they tried to establish a union presence and a small office at this particular location and were shut down.
Though raids threatened to disrupt their practices, trade unions continue to push Parliament to pass new, worker-friendly labor legislation. Due to a number of reasons, though, such legislation is yet to be discussed in Parliament. Among the most important of these is the fact that, for the last 9 months or so, there hasn't been one. As the government begins to form, a number of union leaders are skeptical of how a body which can't seem to agree on itself will reach a compromise on new legislation. Some, however, see hope in the new leadership. Abdullah Mohsin explains why.
President of Iraq, he has signed. We have an appeal. He signed the appeal and he said, I endorse this appeal and for a just call for a labor law. So he signed it. The prime minister has not signed as such the appeal. But he came openly through the Minister of Labor and Social Affairs, and he said openly, I do support workers' rights.
Since the collapse of the Saddam government in 2003, the question of labor has also been a question of priorities. Shauna Baderblau argues that other laws competed for governmental attention.
They spent a lot of time working on an oil law, for example, that was never ultimately passed, but was debated and made a priority for a number of years, and several other foundational laws they focused on about how the new, you know, country would function.
Furthermore, she says that civil unrest in the country has presented a major challenge to passing any fledgling legislation.
And you had periods of time during the Civil War, for example, when the parliament, you know, rarely had a quorum. Many members of parliament were not even able to spend the majority of their time even in Iraq.
Many would agree, though, that passing a new labor law is part of a larger, more fundamental change that needs to take place. In a country which has been ravaged by over a decade of economic sanctions, civil war, and sectarian violence, legislation remains crucially important in securing rights, but is only the beginning. Abdullah Mohsin praises the work of U.S.-based groups in fostering international solidarity with the unions of Iraq.
U.S. labor against the war, who campaigned against the war, and they still are. They are our friends, and we are in direct contact. They are Americans. So in a sense, and so many other Americans, both in the Congress, who wrote so many letters.
The status of labor law and organization in Iraq remains uncertain, but, as Shamal Ali sees it, there remains hope for the future of civil movements in Iraq.
And I know that the situation is very dark, and now you can see it's very dark, but I'm also optimistic that in the first chance for people to have their normal life, we'll see progressive movement appear again, and that will change the face of the Arab society as we see it now.
For War News Radio, I'm Kate Aronoff.
This is War News Radio. This week, the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism at Oxford released a report by Richard Sambrook, the former director of Global News for the BBC, which asks, are foreign correspondents redundant? The study concludes that digital technology and economic pressures are rapidly changing the way international news is being reported and consumed. My co-host Kyle Crawford has more.
In the 1980s, the major American TV networks maintained about 15 foreign news bureaus. Now, there are fewer than six. Networks have shut down their foreign desks in Moscow, Paris, Tokyo, and Cairo, to name a few. In fact, today, there are no network bureaus in India, South America, or Africa, except for a one-man bureau in Kenya. The study is based on Sambrook's experience with the BBC and interviews with a variety of newsmakers and news organizations. He starts by outlining the role that foreign correspondents have played for the last 100 years, and he writes, "We are now entering a new era, where they may no longer be central to how we learn about the world." The study notes a paradox, that even as traditional foreign correspondents become less prevalent, the opportunity to find out about the world is increasing. Andy Mendelson, chair of the Department of Journalism at Temple University, agrees that there has been a drop in the number of foreign correspondents, but he also notes a rising number of local journalists, as Sambrook's study does.
For the last 30 years, there's been a huge decline in the numbers of them, American reporters reporting overseas. The fact that there may be increasing numbers of local people, reporters doing some of this may be a good thing, because we've had the amount of foreign news, international coverage, has been declining steadily over the last 20, 30 years.
Mendelson explains that local journalists can bring important context, both cultural and historical, to their reporting, but that there are also issues we have to be aware of.
I mean, I think that they can be just as good reporters as an American dropping in or living there. There's obligations and that they may feel different from different reporting concerns than an American reporter, which is good and bad. I mean, they may report things in different ways than an American reporter, and that may be a good thing. But it may also limit the story if they're protecting what they think of as their culture or something like that. So that's always an issue whenever you have an insider versus an outsider reporting on a place. But potentially, I think that those additional voices used correctly, used properly could be a very good thing for people.
Sambrook spoke to many journalists who note how easy it is to self-publish and share stories online with the advent of new communication technologies. However, with this increased competition and freely available news, networks are having to cut costs and cut their foreign correspondents. The study notes that social media is now leading, supplementing, and complementing what professional news organizations offer, providing fresh source material, and competing with traditional news for the public attention. In January 2010, some of the first reports of the earthquake in Haiti came through Twitter. Sambrook notes that the public looked to Twitter over traditional media to discuss and rally around the victims of the disaster. Mendelson also says that Twitter is a valuable tool, but that it doesn't help people grasp the context or the history of an event.
I mean, information is not knowledge, and I would even say it's not necessarily information, it's data. And data needs to be sorted and processed to make it useful to people. And a stream of just tweets is not necessarily helping most people understand a larger context.
He agrees with Sambrook that the way the news is being reported is changing, and he wants the public to realize that moving away from the model of traditional foreign correspondence is not a bad thing.
I just don't think we can keep romanticizing this idea that we need to have American foreign correspondents, that we're the only experts on a place other than our country, you know, in other countries. And I think that's the important thing, is there are experts and perspectives that we can learn a lot from without having them be American citizens.
To answer the question, are foreign correspondents redundant? Sambrook says no. It's true the way international news is reported is changing, but the central mission of correspondents is not. Foreign correspondents will continue to be crucial in bearing witness to international events. For War News Radio, I'm Kyle Crawford. This is War News Radio. In our recurring media analysis series, Kareem Sariahmed looks at the coverage of the White House report on Afghan war strategy. Here's Kareem.
I can report that thanks to the extraordinary service of our troops and civilians on the ground, we are on track to achieve our goals. Today, Al-Qaeda's senior leadership in the border region of Afghanistan and Pakistan is under more pressure than at any point since they fled Afghanistan 9 years ago. Senior leaders have been killed. It's harder for them to recruit. It's harder for them to travel. It's harder for them to train. It's harder for them to plot and launch attacks.
That was President Obama on the progress made in Afghanistan since the troop surge last year. He did acknowledge, of course, that the task at hand would be very difficult and would require the cooperation of several different parties, particularly Pakistan. Some less optimistic U.S. intelligence reports released this week, however, stress that Pakistan's lack of cooperation remains a serious obstacle, because the Taliban can still find sanctuary in Pakistan's tribal regions. In the 2 days before Obama's conference, the New York Times reported on this intelligence, as well as the fact that northern Afghanistan is increasingly falling into the grasp of the Taliban. The Times certainly is not the only outlet making sure to temper any optimism in Obama's report. The Washington Post pointed out the tendency for Taliban activity to decrease in the fall and winter, quoting a NATO advisor who called winter the season of eternal optimism in Afghanistan. One anonymous senior defense official, however, suggested that the intelligence reports were out of touch with realities on the ground. He also said that they did not accurately reflect the effects of the troop surge, since the troops hadn't actually all arrived until this past September. A reporter on MSNBC also said that military commanders were optimistic.
When I was in Afghanistan last week with Secretary of State Gates, I've never seen him or the U.S. military commanders there more optimistic about that mission. They do warn, however, that it still remains a long, hard fight and that American troops are going to be on the ground there for years.
While military commanders may be fully committed to the mission, Obama has to wrestle with public opinion, which shows that Americans increasingly think the war in Afghanistan just isn't worth it. An article on the Washington Post about the start of the troop withdrawal scheduled for July concluded by directing a spotlight at these figures as well as the Afghan War's contribution to the U.S. deficit. One official said that Obama is impatient about progress, and another that the cooperation of NATO forces as well as Afghan forces is critical in order for any kind of withdrawal to be possible. An article from the BBC, on the other hand, briefly mentions the polls, before closing with the sobering news that, in an attack attributed to the Taliban, 14 members of a family were killed by a roadside bomb on their way to a wedding. For War News Radio, I'm Kerim Sari Ahmed.
This is War News Radio. Throughout most of the 20th century, Baghdad's famous Al-Rashid Street was home to some of the city's most popular cafes, restaurants, markets, and entertainment venues. Iraqis have a lot of affection for the old street, but since 2003, it's fallen into serious disrepair. Madeline Abramowitz has this report, first aired in November 2009.
Baghdadis call it The Witness. For 100 years, Al-Rashid Street has been watching some of the most important events in Iraqi history. It was once the center of Baghdad's political and cultural life, and a great place to go for a bargain. Nazar Salim spent his childhood on Al-Rashid Street. As a young boy, he started going there to help out in his uncle's tailor shop.
Al-Rashid was a wonderful street. Everything there was beautiful. Its heritage, the old style of architecture, nice shops, a street packed with cinemas and theaters.
Al-Rashid Street is named after Harun al-Rashid, a caliph from the 8th century, who's famous partly for his depiction in the Arabian Nights. The street runs along the east bank of the Tigris River in the heart of Baghdad, a direct route between the north and south gates of the old walled city. The Ottoman Turks planned and built the street in 1910, demolishing all the houses in the way. Supposedly, Al-Rashid Street gets its winding footprint from all the families who paid bribes to save their homes from destruction. In 1925, Al-Rashid Street was the first in Baghdad to be paved for car traffic. Businesses sprang up, and by the 40s, it was the place to go for late-night entertainment. Ali Al-Nashmi, professor of history at Mustansiriya University, calls it Baghdad's first modern street.
It's about 30 nightclubs in that street. In about 2 kilometers. Maybe in Las Vegas only you can find that number of nightclubs now. And more than 20 cinemas and more than 9 theaters.
Al-Rashid Street was where you'd go to find Baghdad's best-known cafes, the Umm Kulthum, named after the Egyptian diva whose music they were always playing. The Al-Zahawi, named for a poet and philosopher who wrote in praise of scientific progress. These places were soon the favorite haunts of artists, students, and new political groups. It was the Baghdad equivalent of the Latin Quarter in Paris.
In the 1950s, it became a street that is a place of meeting for politics and intelligentsia and educated people in the cafes of that street. You know, the newspapers in that time are very few. Anyone who wants to read a newspaper must go to Rashid Street.
Al-Rashid Street is also known for the blood that was shed there. In 1959, Iraqi leader Abdul Karim Qasim was nearly killed by a young Saddam Hussein and his Ba'athist co-conspirators. And until recently, Al-Rashid Street was the place to stage any political demonstration, beginning in 1919, when Iraqis gathered there to protest the British occupation.
Rashid Street is the television of the politics, Iraqi politics, and Rashid Street is the television of the Iraqi culture, of the Iraqi intelligentsia. Television shows a picture. When a party wants to show the others what they are, they use that street.
Many of Al-Rashid Street's theaters, shops, and cinemas closed under Saddam Hussein. Some of the most famous cafes and markets stayed open. But the latest war has taken a heavy toll on Al-Rashid, and few places are still in business. The street was hit hard by bombings and kidnappings. The central bank was looted so badly at the beginning of the war that the street has been closed to all but pedestrians ever since. Nazar Salim.
The central bank cut down Al-Rashid Street. No traffic goes there, and it's surrounded by concrete walls. It really is a tragic situation. There's nothing sweet about this street anymore. When I used to walk by it, we often remembered how nice it used to look.
As an adult, Salim opened his own workshop on Al-Rashid Street, where he made and sold shoes. When the war began, business took a turn for the worse.
Demand was low. No electricity and no safety. I used to go have a cup of tea, sit down, maybe get one customer, or none, and I'd close after 2 or 3 hours, and head back home. Nobody can stay after 4 p.m.
Abdul Jabbar Abbas left his Baghdad home for Romania in 2001. When he went back to see family in July, he made sure to visit Al-Rashid Street, where he and his friends used to hang out late at night. Some things hadn't changed.
There is a famous coffee shop there. I remember when we would pass it on the street, we'd be on the top deck of the bus, and we'd smell the strong coffee from a kilometer away. When I went last time, I had coffee there, and it was the same strong smell. Two things didn't change on Al-Rashid Street, the coffee and the good tea.
But beyond that, Al-Rashid Street has lost most of its old charm.
When you enter the street now, you see a web of electric wires over your head because of the generators that are spreading everywhere, and you hear the noisy sound of the generators. When you go to an old neighborhood that is rich with heritage, you expect it to be a bit quiet, but it's impossible to find a quiet place on Al-Rashid Street.
After years of violence and neglect, the old shops and houses badly need some renovation.
In Europe, preserving the old cities is a national duty. That doesn't exist on Al-Rashid Street. When you walk down the street, you feel the buildings are going to come down on you. God help them.
There may still be a future for Al-Rashid Street. One of its side streets, Al-Mutanabi, was torn apart by car bombs for years, but its famous bookstores have been restored and shoppers are coming back. In May, the mayoralty of Baghdad announced the signing of a $7 million contract to revitalize Al-Rashid Street. But Nazar Salim isn't optimistic that the old ambiance will return.
It's finished. When we walk on the street, we feel so sorry, such pain in our hearts. Why did this happen?
Al-Rashid Street marks its 100th birthday this coming year. Unfortunately, there may be few people there to celebrate. For War News Radio, I'm Madeline Abramowitz.
That's our show for this week. War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College. Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site. Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Anjali Kadambi, Louis Katz, Rosanna Kim, Jonathan Kwan, and Aaron Moser. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Kyle Crawford.
And I'm Sam Hirschman. Until next time, thanks for listening.